Welcome to the Sum of It All, Cultivating Mathematical Hearts podcast. I'm Audrey Mendeville, along with my colleague Mark Alcorn from the San Diego County Office of Education. And this season, we're diving into the book, Cultivating Mathematical Hearts, Culturally Responsive Mathematics Teaching in Elementary Classrooms by Maria del Rosario Zavala and Julia Maria Aguirre. Transcripts are available to our podcasts, and they're always available for you in the episode notes on your favorite platform. This week, we are diving into chapter one. We're starting this book off. Here we go. Culturally Responsive Mathematics Teaching, the Purpose and Principles.
Well, Audrey, the authors kick off this chapter with a vignette from the classroom. And I love that. Such an appropriate place to start with a view into the classroom. I just love how that's the centerpiece of a starting chapter one. And in the background, they include that the educators partnered up to plan lessons that, like the one that we were able to step into, that would position their students as sense makers who are curious about their world rather than troublemakers needing to be controlled, a stereotype that permeated schools with the majority of brown children and families. And I quoted that last part straight from the book. Audrey, such a powerful statement. What I really appreciate about it is the directness of the statement. How do we view our students consciously? And how are we positioning our students? So like, you know, even if we as educators, we quickly discount our complicity, like, no, that's not me. I would never label my students as troublemakers. It makes me wonder, as I say that, how many educators would agree that that's really what we're doing? A couple of things come to mind that are things that you can't ignore, like suspension rates among different student groups. And like the idea of an empathy interview, if we interviewed our students that might be put in that position and interviewed them about their school experiences, I think unfortunately we would see that this deficit labeling is it's unfortunately alive and well in our schools, Audrey.
Yeah, Mark, you bring up a really, really important point. You know, there's a lot of connections to what you're describing here and what the authors kind of share in that opening around that with a book called Troublemakers by Carla Shalaby. And I think there's a lot that we probably need to explore there further. We've touched on that in previous seasons and podcasts and talked about it a little bit. But I think it's going to come up throughout this season as well. And it's something worth exploring. I think we have to kind of weigh both sides of this. So like on one hand, they're saying, how do I position my students as sense makers? And I think we have to think about that. How often am I positioning them as troublemakers? So I'm going to take a moment and shift back into that sense making thing, sure. Not to at all belittle what you're talking about. I think it's worth spending some more time to talk about. And I'm looking forward to the chapters that do that. But to shift back to that vignette for just a second that you were talking about and the positive positioning of students that they describe. I love examples of math classes where students are positioned as sense makers. I do. I love walking in them. I love hearing about them. And this particular vignette is centered around an idea of a school redesign project. And I really just appreciate how the teacher saw math in the project where, you know, like there's this thing happening in their sphere, in their world. And nothing about the project said, this is fourth grade math. But somehow that's the lens that she could see the project through. She had honed that ability and she was able to notice it and she could see it. And she could say, these are fourth grade standards happening right here in this project. I can make these connections for my students. And, you know, I have to like, there's part of this work that is as teachers, as continuing to hone our ability to notice math in our world. You know, school math and world math, we've talked about this many, many times, Mark, like finding those connections. I acknowledge it's so much easier in K-8 than it is in high school math. You know, and 6-8, particularly grades that I love working with. I mean, those standards were written to be about the life and math that people engage in most of the time in their adult lives. But high school math is more specialized. So like I've not yet had the experience of walking around the street and thinking like, whoa, awesome logarithmic functions right there. I should totally use that in
I
class.
haven't
So
done that either, by
good. Thanks. Thanks. That
the
makes me feel better, Mark, actually, that
way.
admission. Thanks for that. And if you're listening in, you can write me and say, obviously, Audrey, you're not looking in the right places and help me see it and hone my abilities a little bit further.
Waiting for those messages.
Yeah, please pop them in. But I do think that's it's both a piece of like K-8 mathematics and a space for us to hone our abilities. So the authors, as they describe in this chapter, this is going to be about kind of two big pieces, the purpose and the principles. And to start off with, they talk about this, their purpose, and they say this quote, "We see children as whole people. They are neither extensions of content or data, nor solely adults in the making. They are living, breathing, thinking, emotional, and social. They are full human beings." And I love this idea, Mark, because I think so often about how we treat our children, elementary and middle and high school students, as if they're not living in the real world. Like we constantly say, like, when you get to the real world, here's what you're going to have to be ready for. Or we're going to give you real world math that exists beyond the classroom, but doesn't exist in your life, right? And it's like, hold on a second. These are fully human beings. They are not like on a trajectory to getting to real life. They are in real life right now.
I'm so glad that you chose to read that powerful statement of purpose. I think that sometimes in elementary, like we're really known for talking about the whole child, right? Like there's a lot of talk about that, but it's interesting how then you go to teach a math lesson, it's like whoop, it's like
Yep.
sort of some of that stuff kind of, oh, wait a second. Oh yeah, the whole child. I was busy doing math. So I think it's kind of interesting how that can kind of like not always carry through. This statement of seeing students as whole people versus extensions of content and data, like that's so true. So what comes to mind, Audrey, is like we often define our students based on scores from digital assessments, right? Or other measures, which actually might have nothing to do with their broader assets that make up their true math identity, or actually that could contribute to them realizing that math identity. But I think sometimes we fixate on these isolated data points, and when we do, we actually might smother any hope of seeing that spark of brilliance that they have to offer the community.
Yeah, I can relate to that. I can see that happening in classrooms and in spaces that I've been working in. And yeah. You know what that reminds me of though, Mark? It reminds me of some of the intervention work that we've seen, or alternatives to intervention that we're seeing kind of starting to crop up in different places. Because I think the typical intervention model in mathematics is to hone in, like you said, on those very specific data points. And I think Rochelle Gutierrez, Dr. Rochelle Gutierrez talks about gap gazing, like look at the specific gap and fill in the very specific gap and treat that gap, right? And locally, we have like a middle school who said, like, what if the issue wasn't just filling in gaps? Like, what if the bigger issue was something else? Like, we can tackle the gaps in a minute, but what if we tackle first how students perceive themselves as math doers or mathers, to use Deborah Pert's word, to think about how they have a mathematical identity themselves. And so that's what they're intervening on first. They're first looking at like, how do I have short videos about how everyone can do math and learn math? And some of that comes out of U-cubed and some of the work that Joe Bowler has done. And then how do they play games that are have a mathematical lens to them that have something to do with that? And how do they help them see that math is playful and that they're students have a natural curiosity and ability to do these things, right? And so their treatment is not of them as a data point, but as a whole human being, saying like, part of the work here is not just saying you have little Swiss cheese holes of knowledge, but instead you have a misunderstanding of yourself. Let me hold up a mirror to you and let you see that you are capable of doing mathematics and you are capable of making sense and doing wonderful things. And so I think instead of just, I think they're being creative in how they hold up that mirror for some middle school students. And I think it fits in nicely to what this book is talking about.
Yeah, Audrey, that's just super promising to me. I just think it's so innovative. I just haven't heard of a group that had the courage to just stop for a second and say, wait, it might be something else. I really appreciate you sharing that. And you know, as I think about my work in elementary over the many years, like I just feel like in elementary is we've been pretty one-dimensional about this for decades in elementary. Like this whole idea of finding this specific skill, this very narrow, isolated skill. But then when we intervene at the skill that's completely out of any larger context of a big idea, it prevents students from bringing their identity into the space so that they can actually build connections from their identity and their background to the content. One of the things that I've been doing is some work with educators about how we might use essential learnings or big ideas that do include skills, but when we hang out more at the big idea level, there's a more of a potential for there to be connections for students that allow them to make some connections, and students in general, but like even more so for our students that we're thinking that might need some intervention in mathematics. So I'm excited by this because I think it allows our most vulnerable students, it gives them the right to problem solve. Like, I think sometimes when we intervene, we pull them out of the problem-solving environment and they're excluded from that because we need to give you an isolated skill that you may not even have any connection to. And so that act of pulling students away from interesting mathematics to practice low-level skills has been just something that's been done for decades and has not produced good results. And I'm excited about this idea of connection. And I think this book is really speaking around this idea of connection.
Yeah, absolutely. So the authors move us into this idea of what is culturally responsive mathematics teaching and where does it come from? And we're going to flip it a little bit and not share the definition right away. If you're reading the book along with us, you've already read it, but and we'll share it in a little bit in case you haven't gotten to this section yet. But it situates this idea of culturally responsive mathematics teaching in the intersection of three pieces of pedagogical content knowledge, culturally responsive pedagogy, and rehumanizing mathematics. And there's a Venn diagram on page six. If when you have your book, you can check it out a little bit. This totally felt like a dive back into my credentials in master's programs. I mean, we're seeing Freire and Vygotsky and Piaget and Geneva Gay. Like, I'm feeling like oh, I'm back and I'm back there reading about these big
In a
folks.
good way, though, right?
In a great way, actually, Mark, in a way that reminds me, I think many teachers, I think we all have this like these ups and downs where we're like, oh yeah, my tool belt is deeper than I thought it was. Like I have more tools hidden under there than I thought I did. And I think it's the same thing with these ideas. Like I think we can look into them and say, oh, there's some other things I knew at one point in time and thought about that I need to go back to. So for instance, let us start off with pedagogical content knowledge. They start talking about how there should be strong connections to constructivism, and they're quoting Piaget there, and social constructivism, which is Vygotsky, and how students should construct their own knowledge, that they are sense makers, that children learn through social interaction and language. And this totally feels to me, Mark, like the work teachers in our county are wrestling with currently. Like, this was probably where we were before the pandemic totally reset things for us. We were wrestling with this deeply, and I think we're back to wrestling with it. Like, how do we get our kids to be sense making, collaborating, learning with each other, where it's not teacher just delivering into empty vessels, but there's this constructivism, there's this socialness to learning. And I think that's part of even why some of the building thinking classrooms work, Peter Liljedahl's work, has been so popular, is that it kind of situates itself back in that those theories of like, students can make sense. Students in social situations and learning, that learning is social, and that through that they can make sense of things and construct knowledge. So, excited to start there with our talk.
Oh yeah, for sure. Just the whole phrase, children are sense makers. This belief statement, it's just really at the center of the work that our team is engaged in here at the San Diego County office. And you know, as we get to the end of that section, Audrey, of pedagogical content knowledge, you know, you painted this picture of what we're after and everything. And in some ways, we might be like, okay, we're set, let's go, right? Like we've got all the info we need. But then the authors do something so intentional. At the end of that section, they're like, yeah, but this isn't enough. This pedagogical content knowledge is not going to be enough. And I'm just going to share a couple quick bullets of what they mention around that. They say, it does not address the issues of power that shape knowledge related to teaching mathematics. They also say, doesn't address what counts as mathematical knowledge. It certainly doesn't address who has access to the learning, right? And it doesn't address the mathematical practices that occur outside the classroom in children's homes and communities. And so I just really appreciated the intentionality of our authors to sort of let us know why we, as much as the pedagogical content knowledge is something we absolutely need to improve on through a lot of the work we're engaged in, like in and of itself, that will not be enough to really achieve the equity that we're after.
A great point. So then they move on to culturally responsive pedagogy, and they say now there's over. Remember, there's overlaps between these because this is a Venn diagram. But they talk about let's move into the space where teachers must center their instruction around students' knowledge and lived experiences. Like you have to start there to bridge to new understandings, and I think that starts to address a couple of the pieces that you talked about, Mark. But what else did you notice in the section around culturally responsive pedagogy?
Well, this phrase here, individual self-worth and an ethic of caring. Audrey, I have to be honest with you. If you would have put that up on a board in a math classroom, that I would have thought that that was for somebody else. Like, I mean, my own, I can only speak for myself, but my mathematical experience would not have fit that phrase there. It seems that in many cases, as I share a little bit of my own, like students encounter school mathematics to be the antithesis of self-worth and caring. Like it can be humiliating and cold. And like, why is that? Like this idea of being hard on students to make them succeed in this subject, that it's just cut and dried. It's something I need to rescue from you from because it's hard for you. So like there's just these all these mixed messages. It reminds me of a story where an administrator said to a parent, and this is the administrator talking, math seems hard for your daughter, and this class is for the top math students. So thinking about those two phrases, right? So this rescue, this so-called rescue, even takes the form of let's get you in your right level where you belong, versus I want to work to free you so you can succeed. So, Audrey, as we read this book, I'm curious to explore this idea of freedom versus control and how being honest about which way we are tending in our practice, like are we tending toward freedom? Are we tending toward control? Like, and how is that impacting our students? And one last thing, Audrey, is that there's a quote that sums up a little bit of what I'm talking about, starts on page 7 onto page 8. And here's the quote. Teachers who might hold a more lockstep, individual-oriented, behavioral approach to learning cannot, by definition, hold a culturally responsive approach to teaching. That's a pretty strong statement there, yes?
It is. It is. And, it reminds me of the work of Andra Tisha Fitzgerald and talking about how
Sure.
you can't do this work of culturally responsive or sustaining pedagogy without UDL, and you can't do UDL without culturally responsive or sustaining pedagogy. There's huge ties here to Universal Design for Learning or UDL for me, and thinking around how we design lessons around the assets and knowledges of our students, and acknowledge the potential barriers that may be inherent in the design and not in the student, right? Saying like
Yeah.
the kids are not the problem
Yeah, they're
here.
not broken. Yeah.
It's the design of my curriculum, it's the design of my lesson that needs
Yeah.
fixing. So I think this is all kind of putting those pieces together for me.
Oh yeah, nice connection to UDL, Audrey. And I mean, I'm just the authors get into this in this section, something I mentioned earlier, and I just want to I want to say it a little bit more about it, Audrey, is just this denying privilege to make meaning as an act of dehumanization, right? And the sad truth is that in our communities where students' potential are fixed based on standardized test scores, what do? We double down and we're going to further dehumanize their experiences with mathematics, not only robbing children of their right to inquiry, but further segmenting the math into these discrete low-level skills, which makes it less likely for them to experience the beauty and joy of mathematics.
Julia, one of the authors, is quoted here as saying, to deny others the opportunity to engage in the process of mathematizing the world, to be able to utilize mathematics to make meaning and connect to other forms of knowledge or to inform a decision, is an act of dehumanization. And I don't know that we always put those things together. I don't know that we always say to ourselves, when I take away the ability to make sense or make meaning for my students, I am dehumanizing them.
Yeah.
I am taking away that part of their humanity and saying, I cannot give you access to full humanity here. Instead, I'm going to treat you as though you are less than. And I think that's a, you know, like, I think if we thought that way, we would take control far less, you know, because none of our teachers, not a single teacher I've ever met, has had the intent to dehumanize a student or to do anything that would take away humanity or that from of any child, elementary or secondary. But I think that's, it's a really important point here, which ties into this third circle of the Venn diagram, again, which all the intersection of all three is where we're going to find our definition for this text. But the third circle here is called rehumanizing mathematics. And this, I think, is kind of that beautiful space of that life is intertwined with mathematics. It always has been, and it always will be. And there's some great examples in the text around like ethnomathematics, spaces that have been studied that haven't been maybe as popularized as before, connections to our world. It makes me think of all of the things that, you know, people are like, that's math. You know, and it's like the beautiful, wonderful, inquisitive, curious spaces. And so that lives in this idea of rehumanizing mathematics. What it popped out to you in this section?
Wow, lots of things. One I'll highlight is that there's just this idea that math has been done every day for thousands of years, you know, all over the world, right? By lots of different people. And gosh, I'm going back to fifth grade, as I do sometimes in the podcast, where I'm like, wow, I wish it would have like done a little better with that. You know, just back to Maya Angelou's sage advice of like, know better, do better. I'm not going to beat myself up about it, but like, gosh, what an opportunity to share that math is more than what's in our curriculum and in our textbook and so forth. You know, one opportunity I did have locally here in San Diego is I did have the privilege to support one of our indigenous communities here in San Diego County. And I worked with their leadership in an after school program. And it was really nice to be in a learner stance to really appreciate the different things that I could learn about that had to do with mathematics as part of that culture. And we worked together to identify mathematics connections, like artifacts, symbols, ways of being in this particular culture, in order for the students to see themselves as practicers of mathematics within their culture, and that their culture has this as part of their culture, just as like we reflect on the thousands of years of people doing mathematics. And it's not just something that resides in this narrow lane of school mathematics, which I think unfortunately defines math a lot of times for our students.
Yeah, it's a great point, Mark. Like this is that proof that mathematics is not culture free. It's not language free. It is richly steeped in both of those. And I appreciate that greatly. So now we have these three buckets, and situated inside of these three buckets comes out the definition of what is culturally responsive mathematics teaching. Mark, do you want to share that definition with us? Because it's so beautiful.
Sure. Oh, yeah, I'd be happy to. And it's at the top of page 6, if anybody has their book. And it's culturally responsive mathematics teaching involves a set of specific pedagogical knowledges, dispositions, and practices that privilege mathematics, mathematical thinking, cultural and linguistic funds of knowledge, and issues of power and social justice in mathematics education. Culturally responsive mathematics teaching interrogates and innovates mathematics instruction to be a transformative and humanizing experience for everyone.
That last phrase, a humanizing experience for everyone. I can't think of a better space for us to end this episode. I think it's going to be an exciting definition to really think about how we live into in this book and in our classrooms. And I'm excited to be on this journey with you. So thanks for that, Mark. I really appreciate it.
Oh, of course. Looking forward to it. Well, thanks for joining us for this episode. In our next episode, we will chat about Chapter 2, Unpacking Culturally Responsive Mathematics Teaching, Retooling Your Pedagogy. Until then, best wishes in cultivating joy and justice in the mathematics classroom.